Hi, this is Derek Jensen on Resistance Radio on PRN, and today my guest is Rachel Ivey, and we will be talking about reproductive rights. And so, Rachel, you recently gave a presentation that was entitled Tactics and Talking Points, Re-Radicalizing the Fight for Abortion Access. And it contained a history that I didn't know. And so I'm wondering if we can talk about, just go through what you think about the notion of being pro-choice and, you know, give your own personal history, how you became politicized in this, and then talk about some of the fallacies with choice.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I think it's interesting that you said that you didn't know any of this history, because I think that's really common. That's true of me as well. I got the opportunity to do that talk at the Stop Porn Culture conference in Boston. And before I started doing research for that talk, I didn't know most of the information that it contained, which is to say that I didn't really know the history of the reproductive rights movement and the history of reproductive control in the United States or anywhere.
And you're saying this is someone who's a longtime activist for this.
Yeah, I think that's what made that realization significant for me. Is I've been doing this about 5 years. I've considered myself a reproductive rights advocate. It's kind of where I cut my teeth on basic organizing, so public education campaigns and lobbying and petitions and phone banks and that kind of thing was where I kind of got started learning how to organize. I got started becoming a feminist around, you know, 18 or 19. And so I thought at that point, and even up until very recently, that I was pretty well-versed in how reproductive rights has progressed, at least in recent times, and the basics of strategy surrounding that issue. But it turns out that I was completely wrong. There's a lot of history that is just not talked about, a lot of premises that reproductive rights advocates are acting on that are largely unspoken, and when they are spoken of, they're largely unexamined. In January of 2013, Planned Parenthood, which is one of the most major reproductive rights advocacy nonprofits, ceased using the term pro-choice in their outreach materials and in their educational campaigns, in the talking points that they send to their trainings of activists. And this was very puzzling to me at the time. I had been heavily involved with Planned Parenthood, both as an employee, as a community health educator, and also before that as a campus organizer. And I could not figure out at first why that would be a smart move. I think my confusion stemmed from the fact that the term pro-choice for me and for a lot of other activists like me, so young, white, college-educated activists, pro-choice was kind of the rallying cry or the ground that we stood on that got us started in activism, that we felt gave us like a unifying point or something to build on. So their abandonment of that, while they did do a lot towards, you know, justifying that and contextualizing it, was really new to me. So I started looking into critiques of the term pro-choice. And I found that while critiques of choice were new to me, they were not actually new. Many activists, most notably activists who are women of color, had critiqued choice for a multitude of reasons, one of the main ones being that it trivializes the expansiveness and the diversity of the reality of the history of reproductive control in the U.S. specifically. So when we look at the reproductive issues that affect all women, not just women like me, we find that access to abortion is only one small part of the ways that reproductive control is leveraged against women. You know, very recently, in the last 2 weeks, it came out that at least 148 women were sterilized coercively without true consent in the California penitentiary system. The last admitted forcible sterilization in North Carolina was 1974. And in June of last year, a class action suit by victims of that forced sterilization they were denied any compensation. So this is not something that's over. It's not something that's ancient history. This more expansive view of reproductive control and the reality of it is still going on today.
So can you go through the existing sort of existing narrative of Roe v. Wade, and before you talk about what is inaccurate about that narrative, can you describe the current narrative surrounding Roe v. Wade? I mean, I know that so many of us were thrilled when the woman in, I can't remember her name, I'm sorry, the woman in Texas did the filibuster, and were appalled, of course, with what the state of Texas has done. We've heard about other states doing similar things. And, you know, Roe v. Wade has sort of been this rallying cry. So can you talk first about the narrative that we're all familiar with, and then talk about some of the things that are inaccurate about that narrative?
Right. Well, first, I'd just like to kind of talk about why I think understanding this is so important. The reality is that 87% of counties in the U.S. have no abortion provider. These restrictions are ramping up every legislative session. In 2012 alone, 43 abortion restrictions were enacted in 19 states. There's a wide diversity of the way that these restrictions have been happening, from outright bans, which are technically unconstitutional, but the point is to challenge Roe and to try to push it to the Supreme Court. Insurance bans like the Hyde Amendment and like the defunding of Planned Parenthood that was huge a few years ago. 45 states have trap laws, which is the part of the Texas legislation that you're referring to that was, I mean, a lot of it was very insidious, but the trap laws were what closed down, or what will be closing down, most of the clinics in Texas. So TRAP stands for Targeted Regulation of Abortion Providers. And they're basically red tape. So they do things like the Texas bill, for instance, makes it so that the hallways in abortion clinics have to be a certain width required for emergency facilities, which abortion clinics do not practically need to be emergency facilities, but that is one way to shut them down. It also requires that abortion practitioners have admitting privileges at the nearest hospital, which are very difficult to get for any doctor, especially if you're an abortion provider. So the extremity and the severity of reproductive control in the U.S. is, the trend is only really going one direction, and you know, the opponents of reproductive justice are very creative and very diligent in their attempts to cut off all access and reproductive control by women.
I'm doing so, I use it insatiable.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that this is understood by reproductive rights advocates. I know that when I was engaged in this work as a campus organizer, there was a palpable kind of urgency. There is a palpable urgency among young reproductive rights organizers that they will not be forced back into the illegal era, the pre-Roe era. And that's kind of where the narrative that we tell ourselves, the story that informs our strategy, begins. So before Roe v. Wade, we say abortion was illegal. And that's a half-truth. I think a lot of elements of this narrative are kind of half-truth, but unfortunately the stakes are way too high to only follow our logic halfway to its conclusion. And it's true that Roe v. Wade federally ended the outright criminalization of abortion, but it isn't as widely acknowledged that the criminalization of abortion has a beginning as well as an end. So in the late 1800s, or the early 1800s, abortion restrictions began to be legislated. And these were, as now, couched in religious language a lot of the time, but they also mirrored rising fears that a white Protestant majority would become a minority. And this is still an idea that sends shivers down the spine of our white male political bodies. So we have quotes from people like Horatio R. Storer, who was one of the leading anti-abortion crusaders at this time, and he says, "Will the West be filled by our own children or by those of aliens? This is a question our women must answer. Upon their loins depends the future destiny of the nation." And Storer was also a physician. So today we have this commonly used talking point that I've used thousands of times, that we want abortion to be safe and legal. But when we put that talking point in the context of the hostile takeover of abortion provision by the medical industry, it becomes a lot more sinister. In the late 1800s, the AMA, the American Medical Association, became one of the leading lobbyists for abortion restriction. And this was a bid for control. They wanted to be the only body that was granted the authority to perform abortion, and they wanted to control the knowledge of how abortion is performed. One of the briefs that they put out during that time says that the frightful extent of abortion in the U.S. is found in the grave defects of our laws with regard to the actual existence of the child before birth. These errors are sufficient in most instances to prevent conviction and are based and only based upon mistaken and exploded medical dogmas. So conveniently, since the need for abortion isn't based on the needs of women or on the realities of living in patriarchy, it's actually just medical misunderstanding. And as the newly knighted medical elites in the just-born commercial medical industry, they conveniently are the only people with the necessary knowledge and expertise to correct these grave defects in our understanding. So what we saw was a subsummation of abortion provision from a community-based structure with midwives and unlicensed practitioners using traditional knowledge, using largely non-industrial types of medicine in order to perform abortion, into what we have now, which is abortion being tightly controlled by both the government in terms of regulating it and also the medical industry in terms of practicing it. So this narrative of abortion being illegal in the time before, where we don't really specify what happened or how it became illegal, leaves us with a strategy that takes for granted the control of abortion access by the medical industry. And I think this is really destructive and leaves us no room for actual change or any way forward.
Let's back up a second. And you were talking about the criminalization and the medicalization of abortion in the 19th century, but can you talk about both pre-contact or pre-conquest, really, pre-conquest indigenous reproductive rights in the United States? I don't know if you can even use the word reproductive rights, but contraception, I guess, is a better word. And also the abilities of women to have abortions and who made those choices pre-1830, say. And talk a little bit about those. And also the word quickening. I just want to mention that from the talk that I read of yours.
Right. So that was definitely very new information to me, too, that the history of reproductive control by powerful European men on this continent goes back way before the official inception of the United States as an empire. So from the very first colonization of this continent, reproductive control has been a method of colonization. So indigenous cultures, both here and elsewhere, depending on which one, there was a wide diversity of attitudes about this, but many of them had traditional methods of contraception and of abortifacients that were largely herb-based that predated the medical industry by thousands of years. So part of colonization and part of the genocide of indigenous peoples that this continent has seen has been the erasure of all traditional knowledge, including medical practices like the practitioner of abortion. And another part of that is that the systematic rape of indigenous women as well. So when we talk about reproductive control, we have to talk about rape at every instance. Some people have almost jokingly noted that when U.S. politicians are talking about reproductive laws, they seemingly can't constrain themselves from also talking about rape and making really embarrassing and offensive statements about it. But there's a context to that, and there's a history to it that goes back very far. And this was, in terms of the U.S., the very beginning of it, that the systematic rape of indigenous women began then and continues today, and that further deprives them of any reproductive control or bodily autonomy that they should have. we can also look to American slavery as another instance where powerful European men use reproductive control in order to ensure colonizing control or class control in terms of white supremacy. So enslaved African women were denied any reproductive control. They were subject to both forced abortion and forced childbirth, and systematic rape was a way of life for those men as well. So, again, this continues today. I mentioned a bit earlier that coerced sterilization is still happening in the United States, mainly regarding women of color within the penitentiary system. So this continues today. So when reproductive activists today talk about reproductive rights, they're mainly talking about white women. And even when we talk about the history of the criminalization of abortion, that mainly relates to white women, because the instatement of laws restricting reproductive control were mainly intended to ensure a white majority. They wanted to make sure that the West would be filled by their children, meaning white children. So these were couched in a sort of xenophobic fever. They wanted to make sure that those who outnumbered would be the ones in charge. And I think that's still true today. It's often an unspoken, because it's rather politically incorrect within the mainstream narrative, but concerns are definitely an undercurrent in abortion restrictions from the very beginning of European colonization up until today.
Well, we actually see this all the time. There are, from a capitalist perspective, there are right now at least two population problems. One of them is that poor people of color around the world are having a lot of babies, and the other is that whites in industrialized nations are not having babies. And capitalism requires increasing consumption, which really in many ways requires increasing population. So I've seen essays by, or op-eds or whatever, by very strong pro-capitalists who are absolutely freaking out at declining birth rates in the industrialized nations. And in fact, what was it, Russia a few years ago had a reproduction holiday that everybody's supposed to go home and have sex, but they got a day off work to have sex so they can have more babies. So that's all very clear. I mean, the racism in that should be just evident to anybody.
Right, and the connection there is really completely absent from the mainstream narrative surrounding reproductive rights. I think we've conceded a lot of ground, mainly due to the omission of all of this history. Something that blew my mind to learn, even after doing this work for so long, is that you mentioned the term the quickening. So today, we kind of take for granted that even if we get some generous legislation surrounding abortion access, when and why and how abortion is performed is still, it's accepted, going to be decided by male-dominated institutions, whether it's the government or the medical industry. But in the early days, up until the early days of criminalization, the cutoff of when abortion became morally unacceptable was called the quickening. And that describes the woman's experience of first feeling the fetus move within her womb. So this is a cutoff point which is subjective, and it's also female-controlled. Her reporting of that event, her perception of that event, is what dictates the moral landscape around abortion being performed. And this is something that we've totally lost touch with today, and I think that's indicative of the degree to which we've kind of lost the thread in terms of the reality of how reproductive control has come about and the implications of what it means for the future.
You know, I don't know if you want to go this particular direction. It's perfectly fine to say you don't. But this whole time, when you've been talking about women controlling, I mean, well, first off, a question, which is, so women were able to determine by the quickening when it was morally or morally not acceptable for them to abort a child, abort a fetus. And they, who were the actual practitioners at this point? Was it dudes? Was it midwives who was actually oftentimes assisting the women with the abortions?
Well, it's an interesting question because there isn't one answer, and I think that that fact is indicative of the landscape surrounding it in and of itself. So today we have a very standardized, commercialized, corporatized medical industry, especially in the United States. So things have been standardized to a large degree, whereas before the industrialization of that practice, before it became an institution, there was a wide diversity of how and by whom medicine was practiced. So we can see a parallel between the institutionalization and the corporatization of the medical industry, as we can with every other aspect of human society, as we became more civilized, became more industrialized. So before this standardization occurred, in some places it was performed by local doctors who were often male, but there also was a very strong, this still exists today, but it's been rather anemic in the aftermath of this industrialization. A midwife infrastructure, and especially in medicine regarding reproduction and regarding female anatomy being passed down from woman to woman. It used to be that it was taboo for men to have knowledge about the mechanics of birth and of reproduction. And that, again, is something that we totally lost. Most women do not give birth with the help of women in their family or women in their community that they look up to and have knowledge about it. They are under the total control. They're often drugged and unconscious and, having birth through surgery where, a surgeon or an obstetrician is making decisions for them, and they're not even technically present for them. But also, there were, colonial home medicine guides in the 1700s and 1800s often contained guides of common herbs that could be grown easily or gathered that could produce an abortion. Now, let's not sugarcoat it. These were not always safe, especially as a more commercial society began to see its inception. There were often traveling salesmen that went around with various, concoctions that could produce an abortion, and some of these were safer than others. But I think the main contrast that I would draw from that is that there was a diversity of ways that this was performed, and, white women, because when we talk about colonial society, that's really who we're talking about when we're talking about these kinds of societies, were thinking of women that were largely controlled on an individual basis by their husbands or fathers, and that did extend to reproductive control in a lot of cases. But in terms of institutionalized legal control of reproduction, that was unheard of until, as I said, beginning in the early and kind of culminating in 1900, by which time every state had abortion regulations on the books, thanks to the AMA.
And I want to go back to, I remember reading a few years ago, I don't remember the number right now, but there were hundreds of herbs that were used by indigenous women in North America for contraceptives. And then also, years ago, I've never understood celery until I read in some feminist book that celery, because it doesn't give you actual calories. I think it takes more calories to chew than you actually get from it.
Mm-hmm.
So I wondered why celery has been around for so long, but it ends up that it had its uses in medieval Europe as inducing abortions.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's pretty. I finally understood celery. But that's the thing I wanted to know. You don't have to go here if you don't want. But this whole thing is also reminding me of the witch trials, in terms of that was part of the European transition from women's control of women's health over to a medicalized industry. At first, it reminds me of how at the frontier, capitalism is often more, well, I was just talking to a friend of mine yesterday who a friend of hers grew up in Bangladesh, and he just went back there for a visit, and he hasn't been back for a few years. And he said they're doing things that everything is incredibly expensive. Everything, the environment is completely being trashed very quickly, and everything. He said people spray paint fruits and vegetables to make them a better color. Actually, use spray paint on them.
Wow.
And the point is that this is what happens when capitalism first really hits hard in an area and is not yet regulated, which is not to say regulations are the answer to everything. But the point is that it seems to me that one of the things that's really clear to me is that if you have some impulse, like misogyny, if you have some overwhelming or racism, it doesn't matter what we're talking about, or hatred of nature, it's going to come out in different ways at different times in society. Excuse me. And once again, you don't have to go here. We can just drop it. But if you want to go here, we can. But it seems to me that this is a continuation of a continuation and a sort of industrialization of the removal of women's control of reproductive health that was certainly happening. I mean, that was part of what the witch trials were, is a lot of the so-called witches were actually non-medical healers, you know, herbal healers, et cetera.
Right.
Is that a direction you want to go, or do you want to head back to where we were going before?
No, I think that's a really important connection to make, and that was also a new connection for me. A woman who attended the first time I actually did this talk pointed that out, and that was something that I had never thought of before. And I think that the kind of stunted history of events like the witch trials that come through to the present day is indicative of a sort of whitewashing of the reality of the motivations behind reproductive control. And you mentioned that this is one way that misogyny and racism come out in everyday society, and there are, you know, different ways that that becomes exposed. And I definitely think that's part of it. But I think that something else that is amiss with the mainstream reproductive rights narrative of today is that reproductive rights activists and advocates are kind of taking and running with the stated motivation of politicians who are enacting these regulations, and they're not questioning it very far. So the line is that today conservative politicians are restricting abortion access in a variety of ways due to the religious conviction that the sanctity of life begins at conception, or out of a misguided and antiquated regressive view of women's role in society. And I think that these are part of it. I think that religion and misogyny are definitely big justifiers of why this is happening. But it seems like an inconsistency when reproductive rights advocates, or when activists or thinking people hear the men in power say something like new greenhouse gas regulations will harm the nation's economy and threaten millions of jobs in the next quarter century. That's from the Republican Party's official platform. We can see through that. We don't take it seriously necessarily. And we can figure out that they're actually saying new greenhouse gas regulations will harm the ruling class's power to extract resources and threaten their profit and dominance. And it's hard for me to figure out why, when politicians say something like, I'm strongly pro-life and I've fought to protect the rights of the unborn my entire career, why can't we see through that rhetoric to what he's actually saying, which is that he's strongly pro-control and he's fought to protect the rights of the ruling class to extract resources for his entire career. So I think it's important to talk about the ideologies behind the justification for these laws, but I also don't want us to lose the material resource extraction that at the heart of it drives forward these restrictions, no matter what their stated motivations are.
Let's be explicit. Let's go back to what the right wing, the politician would say about, I have defended the right to life of the unborn, and I've done that my whole career. So make it really clear to listeners how that is. There was a leap in what you said, which I think is really good, but let's be really explicit and take people through it step by step, because a lot of people aren't questioning it. Make it clear the relationship between what that politician said and the resource extraction.
Right. So I think We have to go back a little bit to Horatio Storr and to talking about will the West be filled with our own children or by those of aliens, and also to talk about the connection between reproduction and capitalism that you mentioned. I think that, you know, I'm a firm believer that the men in power and the institutions they control, they don't really do anything without the motivation of wanting to increase their control and their ability to extract resources. And I think that this is no different. So when the practical effect of abortion being restricted in terms of white women means that there will be more white children, there will be a larger white ruling class. In terms of women of color, it means that resources can be extracted in a different way. There will be a larger class in poverty. When we look at the privatized prison system, more non-white children means more per head in the privatized penitentiary system. So it's both kind of soft extraction in terms of wanting there to be a ruling class, and it's also a very concrete monetary extraction, both in terms of birth, forced or not, resulting in higher monetary extraction for the ruling class of white men. It also entrenches females as an underclass in a variety of ways, women that are tied down into a number of being responsible for a number of children that they did not intend to have. Globally, 3 out of 5 births are unintended. And I think that when we look at the practical effects of what that does, I mean, women are economically, psychologically, ideologically, but materially as well, kind of subjugated in the economic realm. And I think that's not the explicit motivation for the men that are making these restrictions. I can't imagine them ever explicitly saying that that's the reason for these restrictions. And I think that people get really tied up in their religious motivation. But when we look at the practical effect of these restrictions and the way that they are enacted, they facilitate the extraction of monetary resources, and they also entrench women's second-class status, which contributes to them being seen as resources themselves to the male ruling class, and also facilitating the economic dominance of men. And I think that reproductive rights advocates and pundits point this out all the time. If they're so pro-life, why do they, you know, send drones after children? Why do they cut food stamps programs? Why do they sentence children and families to poverty? Why do they outlaw birth control if they want abortion to go away? And they're right that this is inconsistent, but they don't follow their logic to its conclusion. If it doesn't make sense for that to be their reasoning, then what is their actual reasoning? And I think, based on things we've said in earlier in this conversation, the only way that I can make it make sense, the only way that I can get a coherent motivation out of them is to look at the material extraction of resources and the preservation of white men as a ruling class as the only motivation that makes sense.
I'm thinking also of, I don't remember who it was, but there was a female activist, it's a woman, who during World War I was arrested for saying that basically women should not be considered, I believe it was brood mares, you know, raising children to be sent off to slaughter in wars.
Mm-hmm.
And she was arrested and might have been sentenced for that, which seems part of it too.
Definitely.
So what, it seems like we have about 10 minutes left, and so what I guess what I'd like to end with is having done this analysis, what do you I mean, and doing the analysis is enough, but also what do you propose? And is there anything else you want to talk about with this before we get to your actual sort of proposal?
Well, I think the one big thing left to talk about is Roe versus Wade and the way that we regard it. I think, so Cecile Richards is the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, and she's quoted as saying things like, Roe v. Wade gave America's women the right and the opportunity to plan for their families and control their reproductive health. So I think part of what I propose should be done in terms of getting our strategy towards something that could actually begin to work, the first thing I think would be to begin being realistic about what Roe actually does. And Cecile Richards is wrong on both counts. Roe v. Wade does not give America's women the right or the opportunities to plan for their families or control their reproductive health. What Roe actually does is codify medical control of reproductive processes into law. Nowhere in the actual text of Roe does it talk about a woman making a decision on her own. Every time it talks about a woman's decision, it says a woman and her physician, which, if you don't know the history, sounds rather innocuous. But once you do know the history of the hostile takeover of abortion access and the performance of abortion as a procedure by the medical industry, it becomes a lot more sinister. So I think we need to look at how Roe is actually being used and some of the major loopholes that Roe left and how those loopholes have directed the actions of those who want to restrict women's reproductive autonomy. The text of Roe states very explicitly that if the personhood of an unborn fetus could ever be proved in a court of law, if there could ever be precedent for the fetus as a person, Roe's case would collapse, and there would be no Roe v. Wade if that could be proven. And unfortunately, that has already been proven. Personhood, fetal personhood has been passed in North Dakota, and it's been attempted to be passed in a lot of other places. It's been very close in a lot of those places. So when we talk about the actual effect of Roe, what we're seeing is that hundreds of women have been arrested or detained for supposedly endangering their pregnancies. So basically any pregnancy that does not result in live birth has the potential of being criminalized today. So in 2009, Nina Buckhalter was indicted by a grand jury in Mississippi for manslaughter. They claim that she did willfully, unlawfully, feloniously kill Haley J. Buckhalter, a human being, by culpable negligence. And this was after Nina had a stillbirth at 31 weeks. The National Association for Pregnant Women has documented more than 400 cases across the country in which these laws have been used to jail or detain pregnant women, and unsurprisingly, 71% of these are likely to be low-income women. So I think that what we see today is a lot of otherwise dedicated, enthusiastic, intelligent activists kind of hanging their hat on Roe and thinking that if we can just preserve it, if we can just keep it alive, it'll all be okay. And I think that that's a comforting thought, but it's not one that matches up with the reality of the situation. So I think that an effective strategy begins with realizing the legal ground that we stand on, and right now there isn't a lot of that left.
Okay, so that's great. Everything you're saying is really, I think, very important, and also I think going to be new to a lot of people. And so what are you actually suggesting?
I'm suggesting that lay people begin to learn how to perform abortions. It's not a complicated procedure. I think that the history we have of abortion regulation erases non-institutional practitioners that have been very successful, people that performed in the illegal era that were not the sort of boogeyman suggested by mainstream reproductive rights activists of the back alley butcher. We have women like Ruth Barnett, who for many years performed abortions illegally in Portland. We have women like the Jane Collective, who operated a floating abortion clinic in Chicago in the years directly preceding Roe, and they had a rate of complication equal to the institutional practitioners at that time. So I think that my worst fear is that total inaccessibility of abortion will sneak up on us, that the last doctor will stop performing abortions, and we won't have a backup plan. Or, as it's already happened, most women cannot access abortion. If you are not economically privileged, if you don't happen to live in one of the 13% of usually very urban counties that have abortion providers, in a lot of ways you are effectively cut off from having access to that right. And I think it's long past time that we stop accepting the total control of abortion access by the government, by the medical industry. And I think that as long as we accept the total institutional control of abortion by those major institutions, we accept failure. It hasn't always been this way. The NARAL, which is the National Association for Reproductive, I can't remember that acronym, but they used to be called for the repeal of abortion laws, not the reform of abortion laws, the repeal of abortion laws. So they understood that as long as the men in power had access to that supposed right under their institutional thumb, it would never be safe. And as long as they had it under their control, they could use it as a bargaining chip to control us, which is exactly what's happening now. So I think that we need to think bigger. I think that we need to get to a place where we're willing to act toward actual reproductive control, where we're not accepting the false choice of would you rather have an abortion from the exploitative man in a back alley or the exploitative man in a white coat? I don't want either of those. And I think that most women, once they know this history, come to a similar conclusion. And I think it's a matter of being realistic about what's happened in the past, where we are now, and what we actually hope for the future.
So a couple things. One of them is that when you say that you want lay people to do it, the first thing is like, oh my God, but it's a medical procedure, it's scary, which is pointing out the degree to which I, and by extension many of us, have bought into the medicalization. And then the second thing I think is, you know, I have Crohn's disease and I've dealt with a ton of doctors over the years. And some of them have been fabulous, and there have been medical procedures that have saved my life that were done in hospitals. And at the same time, I've had some doctors who were just terrible.
Right.
And my point is that medicalization is no guarantee of safety anyway.
I had
a guy doing a colonoscopy on me one time, this is 25 years ago, that the first thing he said to me is, man, I really got hammered last night. I got a terrible hangover, but it shouldn't affect what I do here. It's like, seriously, you want this guy putting something inside of you that could perforate your intestines? And that was within a medical school hospital, you know? And so I just wanted to say that. And then I also wanted to say that, I mean, so there's immediately when you say that, there's a little bit that's scary. But then I also think about, I mean, it sounds to me like what you're saying is that you're wanting for this, and let me know if I'm way off base with this or if this is a lot of what it is. But you're wanting for this process to be not only, you want the control to, not only for the control to go away, but you want for the process to be demystified, just like it was not yet mystified in the 1820s. And yes, there have been advances in science and things, you didn't say that they were all rosy back then, but you want for it to be demystified and to return really to be something that is not, you know, that you don't have to go to the Wizard of Oz to get it done, but instead you recognize, oh God, this is such a terrible metaphor, but you recognize that you don't need the man behind the curtain. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, I think that sums it up very well. I think that there's a lot of information out there about the medicalization of birth. There's a great movie called The Business of Being Born that taught me, and I think a lot of women of my generation, about that. And there's been a strong movement by women and by midwives to reclaim the process of birth. And with some of those same fears, women thinking, well, you know, this is scary. This is something that has been totally subsumed by the medical industry. There are risks to taking that into your own hands. And I think the same is true of abortion. We've seen the medicalization of abortion concurrently with the medicalization of birth. And I think we need to take a similar attitude with it, which is that it's absolutely right, and I think it's very reasonable. I feel a lot of that same apprehension in advocating this, and I didn't come to that conclusion lightly. I come to it because I think that we don't have any choice at this point. I think that unless we look past the legal and medical regulation of it as the best we can do, we're going to lose that control altogether. So I think that that's very valid, and I think that's a conversation that needs to keep happening. And I think that when I talk about the medicalization of abortion being a bad thing, I don't mean that all medical abortion providers are bad at it or are bad people or are consciously representing that. I think there are probably as many good and competent and understanding abortion practitioners as there are kind of callous and cavalier ones. One of my heroes, and I think a lot of abortion advocates' heroes, is Dr. George Tiller, who was killed in Kansas in 2009 in his church by Scott Roeder. And I think that, you know, we need to look to practitioners like him as kind of trailblazers in terms of being unapologetic about the need for women to control that right. So when I talk about resisting the medicalization of that procedure, I don't mean that we should reject a practitioner just because they have a medical degree. I think that practitioners that have medical degrees can participate in giving back this control to women by teaching them about the process and by training them. What's happened is that the medical industry and the cultural guerrilla warfare against abortion and the government have collaborated to condense knowledge of abortion and the authority to perform it into just a few people. And what's happening now is that those people are being taken out by means of intimidation or red tape or bullets. The effect is the same. And I think that we need to look past this kind of anemic legal defense. I think we need a diversity of tactics in terms of attacking this fight. Our opponents are not restricting themselves to legal tactics. They're not restricting themselves to trying to convince politicians to not obliterate women's bodily control. They're using direct action, and we are not. And I think that's why we're losing, and I would like to see that change.
Well, thank you so much, Rachel, and thank you for listening. And this has been fabulous. And this is Rachel Ivey with Derek Jensen on the Progressive Radio Network for Resistance Radio. Thank you very much.